Welcome to Unconcluded. I'm Sean Gert. Over the last couple weeks, the Kesey family and Jennifer's friends have come together to answer questions that were submitted by the community to Jennifer Kesey's Facebook page. And the family responded in several posts on their GoFundMe page that they've been using to raise money for the investigation that they've taken over since settling their lawsuit with the Orlando Police Department. Now, after poring over the various questions and responses, it became obvious that it would probably be a good idea to address some of these answers right here on the podcast. For a lot of reasons. Some new information, some possibly changing information, and also because we know that many of you will be hearing this information for the first time. Now, as you may know, many of these questions we already had answers to because we'd asked Drew or Joyce ourselves, or because they'd been shared in the media or at press conferences or on other forms of TV or print media. And for that reason, we may not touch on every question that was answered. Therefore, we do definitely encourage you to visit the Help Find Jennifer Kesey GoFundMe page, which is where all the original questions and answers were posted. It's worth checking out for yourself. And while you're there, maybe you'll throw a buck or two to the family in support of their investigation. Now, you'll hear later in the answers, the financial limits of the investigation have actually hindered the ability to do some things that the family wants to do as they search for Jennifer. So I know they'd really appreciate it. Now, let's dive into the questions and answers, and I'll share some thoughts that we have along the way. Now, the first question is about video after Jennifer disappeared, and it asked, did law enforcement check for possible video from surrounding businesses and homes? And we talked briefly about this before, but the family's answer was as follows. Yes, through our obtaining case files, they've received 67 hours of film, but they're still working with the Orlando Police Department to receive some case files. They did say that some videos are hard to work with different formats, and that most of the video, unfortunately, all you can really see is the major roads and parking lots like CVS Drugs, Walgreens, and gas stations. Now, we talked about this previously. I don't think that we have a lot to add here, except I do kind of like the idea that there is a second set of eyes, so to speak, getting put on these videos with the Keseys and their private investigation team. So should they see something, it'll be something to be able to follow it up on. But also remember that this is 2006, not 2020. The quality of video, the amount of cameras that were posted in certain places, just not nearly like it is today. So I can understand how, while there is a lot to look through, the idea that there could be something there that had not been seen before probably isn't super, super likely. Now, the next question is something that we had actually known for a little bit of time, but it was something that has not yet been shared on the podcast. So I wanted to make sure that we did share it. The question had asked, did law enforcement check Jennifer's car for fingerprints or anything else from the person who dropped her car off? And if so, was anything discovered? And the answer was as follows. Jennifer's car was processed as a crime scene. The person within the car who dropped it off did a good job of wiping down the inside of her car. There was one latent print found in her entire car. Years later, it was identified as Jennifer's. And that is kind of new information for those of you listening. We had been aware of that previously, but yeah, the latent print that they've talked about before was in fact Jennifer's. And I had mentioned before that I wasn't really concerned about that, and this was the reason why. Now, the question did also go on to say that there was a minuscule piece of trace DNA on a piece of fabric that the family is not in possession of by law. And to their knowledge, nothing has been done with that to date. So they have asked for it to be processed, but it's fallen on deaf ears. So they did say they will be sharing some additional vehicle photos in the near future. So that's something that we can look forward to as well. So it is interesting, I think, that the latent print was Jennifer's. And I think for investigative reasons, the police probably didn't want to say that in hopes that, you know, maybe the suspect would think that they had more information on them than they did. But unfortunately, that is the case here. The next question kind of goes back to her place of employment. It says, have any of her coworkers expressed anything different about Jennifer before she went missing? Was she upset, worried, anxious, concerned? Coworkers usually know more since most of us spend 40 plus hours a week at work. And the response was, from those who worked with her on a daily basis, knowing a large percent of them personally and having spoken to them personally and having read their law enforcement interviews within the files, it seems nothing was unusual with Jennifer. Her work location was very large in population, as well as many locations in the area. so we can't say what she may have had going on with the people in her immediate work setting and other locations. Again, nothing new here, but it is interesting to hear that the case files also support this line of thinking as well. Now, the next question heads back to Jennifer's condo. It says, did OPD check the condominium, like under the ground? And the family's response, no. Jennifer's condo has never been processed. Jennifer's absence was treated like a runaway. She probably had a fight with her boyfriend and she'll be back, the Orlando police officer had told us. After that, we took action. We had 14 people in the condo when the police decided to take things seriously. We were then told that the crime scene was ruined by having 14 people around. What a joke. Jennifer never stood a chance with the first responders' actions and the agency's continued inactions at the most crucial time in a missing person's case. OPD never prevented anyone from coming in or out of Jennifer's condo after she was reported missing. And I think this is important to share because this goes back to something that we had talked about very early in our podcast. The inaction of the investigation when Jennifer first disappeared. And it is sad to hear, and you can hear it, even though it's typed words, of the family's frustration over the early and continuing investigation. The next question was also about her condo, and it came from someone who actually lived there. It said, I lived in the complex 5 months after Jennifer went missing. There was a shady sales team and manager. Has anyone spoken to them? I was given a second condo there due to mold in mine, and someone tried to get in at night and had a key. The next morning, we had an argument with the sales staff about who has access and keys to the condos. And here's the answer. First, they said, if we haven't spoken to you, they wanted to reach out. And Scott and I had actually heard from someone with a similar story, and we're still in the process of getting in contact with that person again, and we'll be forwarding that person to the family as well if we are able to. I'm not sure if this is the same person or not, but I did want to point that out. The family also said, we found a few weeks after Jennifer was taken that a complete set of keys for the complex was stolen. We have also been made aware of at least 5 women in the complex who had someone enter their property unauthorized and unannounced while in the condo themselves. I also personally viewed a key-making machine in the maintenance office with a full box of uncut keys next to it. I questioned why it would not be secured, and the staff looked at me like I was crazy. So many people had access to making a key on location. Again, we found this out after Jennifer was taken. This is interesting. I had never heard this before. And so when I did read this, I thought it was kind of compelling that they have at least 5 women who had their condos entered while they were in them. And, you know, if we start to think back about whether we think Jennifer was taken from her condo or from her car or outside, you know, this makes from her condo a certain possibility, people with access to keys and a history of these kinds of things happening in the condo complex. Now, we don't know of any other women who went missing. But certainly at least people having access to their condos without permission is cause for concern. I did want to mention one more question, and the answer to this question isn't super compelling, but I think the answer itself is kind of worth repeating and just sharing the frustration with the Kessie family. It says, would it be worth interviewing people again, such as the boyfriend, ex-boyfriend, male employee who was interested in her? And the response was one sentence. They said, due to the incompetence and arrogance of the initial detectives, it would be useful to re-interview everyone. And I have nothing to add to this. It's just that continued frustration that we felt from the beginning. It really comes through in that answer. True crime may be my passion, but even I need the occasional break. So when I feel like I need a mental palate cleanser, my go-to refresher is the game Best Fiends. The puzzles and challenges are right up my alley. But while Best Fiends has challenging puzzles, it's a casual game anyone can play. But it's made for adults. It's also great that you can spend as much or as little time as you like in the game. I'm currently on level 31, and I can't wait to get back in there and go even further. I hop on Best Fiends whenever I have a free moment in the day, and I even got Scott playing with me now too. The game has great bug characters, bright colors, and a visual style which just adds to the experience. The challenge of each new level keeps me wanting more, and it's even better with friends and family. In fact, I'd love to see all of you joining in on the fun. Another great part about Best Fiends is that it doesn't require being online to play. If you're stuck without great service in the subway or on a plane, you can still enjoy the strategy of figuring out each new level. It's really a unique and exciting puzzle experience, unlike any other puzzle game out there. So engage your brain with fun puzzles and collect tons of cute characters. Trust me, with over 100 million downloads, this 5-star rated mobile puzzle game is a must play. Download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends. Now we're going to head to the phones. I know Jennifer's phone was completely powered off and down immediately following her 10 p.m. phone call with her boyfriend. I also know that when you guys arrived at her condo, you found her shower to still be wet and a damp towel was laying around. Because of these details, there have been some conflicting reports about how some people who thought Jen was abducted that night after she hung up the phone with her boyfriend, and others who believe she was abducted in the morning. Do you personally believe that she was abducted the night before or the morning of January 24th? And here's the response from the family. This is a very important question, and one that I personally, and I believe this is Drew typing this, have spread misinformation on. You see, there is what people talk about, what LE, law enforcement, tells you, and then there's the truth. I, Drew, for years have felt that I was told by law enforcement that the phones were manually turned off or destroyed at approximately 10:20 p.m. 1/23/2006. That is simply false information. And in my heart, I believed that for years. The ping study presented to us showed such illogical locations and times and pings off towers that made absolutely no sense. Yet again, law enforcement was pushing that Jennifer was out and about after 10 p.m. that night, and that we didn't know our daughter. Again, we plainly showed law enforcement how absurd their thought process was in the ping study. And about 2 years later, I was able to convince a detective to get with a Verizon specialist on the ping study and see if anything had changed when a real professional looks at it. That was done, and we were told by the detective that the Verizon specialist said the entire ping study was no good and totally unreliable. Once again, it was all new technology and the towers were always shutting down, skipping to another, etc. In the end, the data was totally flawed and not to be believed as per Verizon. So it is non-factual information to us. Now, we had heard on our podcast, when we had talked to Drew previously, him say something similar to this. Not quite as detailed, but along the lines of that the ping study was irrelevant and that they really didn't consider it factual. I think getting a little bit more detail here, it does seem, and I think for our purposes and everyone out there, that we really can't hang our hat on any of the information surrounding the phone. And as far as the information that Drew thought he had heard about it being turned off, they now have the files, and he is saying that it is false information, meaning that information is not in the files either. So again, maybe he misheard, or it was something that was later determined to not be true, but I think, like he says, it gets thrown out. And for a lot of people, that 10:20 turnoff, or 10:40 as I'd seen it published before, was a reason that people believed she was abducted the night of the 23rd. That information is now, for all intents and purposes, irrelevant. So does the night of the 23rd still make sense? I think it's possible, but a lot of the reason why people would hang their hat on that, I think, has been eliminated from the equation. Now, let's head to the knock at the door. Now, this has been something that we even addressed in our last episode, and it's something that has been talked about forever since Drew had come on our podcast and talked about the knock on the door. The question says, please explain the knock on the door. Was it Monday, January 23rd? Who was she on the phone with at the time of the knock? And what were her exact words? If it was a neighbor, was the neighbor male or female? So here we get the clarification that we had talked about previously, but I think it's worth for sure sharing the family's words again. Jen was on the phone with her childhood best friend at the time of the knock. Here's what she says about it. It was relatively soon after she moved into the condo and someone knocked on the door. I am not exactly sure of the date, but I know it was not on the 23rd as I talked to her earlier that day. It was probably around 8 or 9 p.m. I remember asking if she was going to check who it was, and she said that she did not need to answer the door to anyone that late at night. She also told me another time, one of her neighbors unexpectedly knocked on the door to introduce himself. She said he was nice enough, but I think she was a little skeptical of everyone at this point because it was all new and Jen approached everything and everyone with caution. So some more information as far as the source of the knock, and there was a knock, but again, the date, not what we originally thought, and certainly changes some of the implications behind that. I don't want to spend too much time on that because we've kind of gone into length of that on the previous podcast. Now, there are three short response questions, and there's not a whole lot to add to them, but I do want to share them just for everyone's information out there. Question, did Jen use an alarm clock or did she rely on her cell phone's alarm to wake her up? The answer was she had both. Question, did Jen have any social media accounts other than MySpace at the time of her disappearance? Answer, no, and we actually don't remember her even having a MySpace page. If there was one, we believe it was created after she went missing, which is kind of interesting. And then question, was Jen still in contact with her ex-boyfriend, Matt, at the time of her disappearance? Answer, not that anyone close to her was aware of. Now, let's go back to the morning that Jennifer was reported missing. There are some questions about the complex and the events that led up to the Kessie's arrival in Orlando. Question, did the Mosaic management actually enter the condo when you called to ask them to check on Jen? Or did they just knock and go away? Answer, the management, two employees, did knock and then enter her condo to inspect it for us. This was done while we were on the phone with the manager while driving to Orlando 1/24/2006. He found nothing unusual and neither did we upon our arrival. Now, the second question said, OPD opened Jen's trunk when they found her car. What was in it? Nothing of forensic value such as blood, etc. We have a full inventory list and pictures. From what we can tell, it was all Jennifer's stuff. The only item that we were not familiar with was the DVD player strapped into the back seat with seatbelt. This was given to Jennifer by her boyfriend. Just weird, it was strapped in. Now, I do want to talk about this for a second because that last sentence is interesting to me. It was weird that it was strapped in. And a lot of us have kind of made the assumption that perhaps Jennifer's boyfriend at the time, Rob, had strapped it in for her or that she had strapped it in before leaving Fort Lauderdale. But hearing them say that it was weird that it was strapped in leads me to think that maybe that wasn't the case. So it really makes no sense to me why a perpetrator, for example, would strap in a DVD player. Also, remember her birthday ball. I think we had talked about that in an old episode. It was kind of wedged between the seats in front of the DVD player, maybe as a way to prevent it from sliding forward. It's awful weird, but again, it's hard to really imagine a scenario where that would play anything into Jennifer's actual disappearance. Now let's move on to some other questions. Question, on January 23rd, 2006, around 10 p.m., did Jen talk to Rob on her landline or her cell phone? Answer, it was on her cell phone. This is interesting. I think a lot of people had assumed it was her landline. For us, I don't think we'd really thought about it either way. But certainly it being on her cell phone opens up some new possibilities. For example, she could have been speaking to him, not tied to her actual condo. I don't think this was the case, but it does open up that, you know, possibility. Had it been on her landline, it would have basically determined the fact that she was inside her condo while she was talking to him. Now that we know it was on her cell phone, that possibly could not have been the case. But at this time, we have no reason to believe that. Now, this next question is worth sharing. I don't think for me it's new information or anything I didn't know, but I think for a lot of listeners, this may be something that helps answer a question that a lot of people have about the Kessies being able to share information from the case files. The question said, can you talk about the type of investigations that have taken place with regards to the people who lived at Jen's condo complex? Answer, just too many to sit here and ramble them off. We have had many people come forward who lived there before, during, and after Jennifer did. Some we have gotten to review via case files. I want, at this point, to make something very clear. We will never be able to publicly name any person slash people of interest. None, for many reasons. We are not law enforcement, and we do not enjoy the same laws and rules that they get to play by. I think this makes sense. This is something that I totally expected, and a lot of you did too, but there have been a lot of people asking the Kessies, and asking us for that matter, if we thought that the Kessies would start, you know, rambling off names or sharing information about specific people in the files. And I think legally, that's just not something that they can do. And that doesn't even take into account the idea if they would be willing to. So I think people that are expecting that to happen are going to be disappointed. Question. Do you know if the vacant rooms around the premises to Jen's rooms were searched? I've always wondered if she was taken to a vacant room somewhere away from her condo. Answer. To our knowledge, there was a search of all vacant units by OPD. At least in writing, they said all were searched. To our knowledge, all units on the property were locked except one, the unit across from Jennifer's. It was searched and scent dogs did go in the unit with negative results. Again, we talked about this previously, but it is interesting hearing that in the notes that all vacant units were searched by OPD. But remember, a lot of units were not vacant, so those ones would not have been searched. Question, is there anything relevant to Jen's disappearance that you are aware of that hasn't been released to the public? Now, I think this goes without saying that yes, the answer here, but the family confirms that. Their answer is yes. We will be releasing new, never seen before pictures of her car just as soon as we finish some additional due diligence on what we believe we have to offer the public as additional evidence. Please bear with us. So I think this is pretty interesting. And the fact that they want to release some additional photos means that there might be something worth seeing. And so I think we're all kind of looking forward to those photos and what may be in them or the possibilities or the things that we can consider with any kind of new evidence or new information. I think that's at this point what everybody is looking for. So we'll be sure to talk about that and share that with you when it comes out. And, you know, obviously, I'm sure some of you will see it before us and let us know. So we'll look forward to that in the future. Question, could Jennifer have forgotten something in her car that night, the 23rd, and left the door open to get it quick and someone snuck in and hid inside her condo? Answer, since we have very little factual evidence, I have to answer yes, anything could have happened. Do I think she went out? No. But everyone breaks their habits, so we leave it open in our minds. I think that this is something that we had talked about before. You know, she's coming back from her trip. Maybe she had walked out to grab something out of her car and something happened at that point. I do not think for any amount of time that Jennifer would have left the door to her condo open while she did this. I think that's certainly a stretch. But again, you know, we can't say no on any of these things. Now, this next question is something that I did find extremely interesting. And it says, what time did the landscaping company arrive and notice Jen's car wasn't there? And for a while, this is something that we had seen in various places. But the answer says, your question is interesting. Who has mentioned the landscape company determining Jennifer's car was not in her space? That would be total news to me. So I think it's pretty telling that the family doesn't really know where this came from. And again, it's just a long line of misinformation that's been passed around in this case. And I think we'd even talked about that way back in our very beginning episodes when we were really relying on what had already been out there in the media. Question, will you ever release Jennifer's records from law enforcement to the public? No, is the answer, but we will release factual items we feel will help the case if, by law, doing so will not hurt us. Again, not a surprising answer, but some people that were hoping that they would dump the files may be disappointed by that answer. Now, here are some very specific questions and some various answers that we can talk about. Did Jennifer's banking records show any transactions at Northbridge, especially in January 2006? The answer here was no. Remember, Northbridge is the location that we had the woman, Erica, on the podcast, who said she believed that Jennifer had visited her place of work in January 2006, as well as she had thought someone resembling Jennifer had been pushed into a black car the night of January 23rd. So it would make sense if, you know, people asking if there was some kind of financial records to show Jennifer being at that location. There was one or two places of business, perhaps a nail place or something like that. I wouldn't have expected this to be the case, even if those sightings did happen to be Jennifer. And again, whether those were or not is questionable as well. So not surprising there. The next question involved us. Did the guys from Unconcluded Podcast really request to search the church grounds? And if so, why was the request turned down? Well, let me give you Drew's answer first, and then you'll give you our answer. Drew says, I don't know. I don't really know them. I only have spoken to them a few times. Each time, the public has had the chance to hear what was discussed quite openly on their podcast. I don't know what they do or what they invest their time in. First of all, the only people that can really answer this question are us. And that is that we attempted to contact the church. And the reason for doing that would have been to request, you know, some kind of access to their grounds. But we never actually got in touch with them. All of our attempts to contact them more or less went unanswered. So our request was not turned down. We just were never able to make the request. So I did want to clarify that for the person who is asking that. Now, I do want to talk about this answer because we have gotten, I don't want to call it hate mail, but we have gotten a couple emails and people posting things online that our entire podcast is a sham and that we make stuff up and that we obviously fabricated everything that the Kessies have said in response to this particular question. So Drew said, I don't really know them. I've only spoken to them a few times. Each time the public has had the chance to hear what was discussed quite openly on their podcast. Yeah, so all of that is true. He doesn't really know us, and we don't really know him. We've met once in person. We've talked on the record for the podcast, I believe, three times. Off the record, phone conversations, I don't know, a handful, maybe another two or three times. I've talked with Joyce, two to three times or so on the record. You heard those early in the podcast. And I've text messaged and emailed with Drew over the course of all this time. Here and there, not super frequent, but, certainly more than once or twice. So that would be the nature of our relationship. So I'm not sure what people were expecting, that the Kessies were, doing something in the background to produce the podcast or something like that. We've never said as much. We've been pretty upfront that we are an independently produced podcast. We have contacted and spoken with the Kessies as we do that. But it's not a situation where, we're reporting to them or that they know everything that we're investing our time in. And in fact, I think it's better that way. In fact, I remember early on Drew telling me something about, he didn't want to influence what we were doing by, telling us all of his thoughts on certain things. And that makes sense. I think us being a separate entity is the way that it needs to be. But that said, the people who are saying that, our podcast is irrelevant and fake, or that we've made stuff up because of what Drew Kessie said in response to this question, to me, just it makes no sense. I don't think that we've ever said that our relationship was anything more than the conversations that we've had. And most of, a lot of them you've heard personally. So I just wanted to kind of put that out there and say, I'm not sure what these particular individuals are expecting. There's one gentleman who posts on Facebook quite frequently, who said that we're not to be believed and we're a complete sham and
nothing that we say is true
and Drew Kessie doesn't know us. Okay, well, I'm not sure what you want from us, buddy. But, we're pretty open and straightforward with what we do and who we are. So I did want to put that out there just as kind of an explanation from our end as far as the church goes. And then, certainly as far as the people who seem to be upset by that response. I don't know what you were expecting or why you would have thought that it was something other than that to start with. Is there something interfering with your happiness or that is preventing you from achieving your goals? Well, I've got something you're going to want to try. It's BetterHelp. You see, BetterHelp will address your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist, and you can start communicating in under 24 hours. Let's be clear, this is not a crisis line, and it's not self-help. It is professional counseling done securely online. There is a broad range of expertise in BetterHelp's counselor network, which may not even be locally available in many areas. The service is even available for clients worldwide. You can log into your account anytime and send a message to your counselor. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses, plus you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions, so you won't ever have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room as with traditional therapy. Additionally, BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy and free to change counselors if needed. It's also more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid is available. BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today. Visit their website and read their testimonials that are posted daily. Visit betterhelp.com/unconcluded. That's betterhelp.com, and join the over 700,000 people taking charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. We've also got a special offer for Unconcluded listeners to get 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/unconcluded. Again, get 10% off your first month of BetterHelp by visiting betterhelp.com/unconcluded. That's betterhelp.com/unconcluded. All right, let's get back to the questions. Was Jen the first one to live in her specific condo? If not, were locks changed when she moved in? No, the Mosaic at Millennia was actually built as a rental apartment community. With the boom in real estate going on, the ownership decided to take it private ownership from rental status. Jennifer had at least three other people, families, who occupied her unit that we know of. Jennifer was the first to own her condo. And yes, there were very few people living in her particular building at that time. When a renter's lease was up, they had to vacate their unit so it could be sold. New locks were not installed on her doors. We had purchased them, but for a reason I can't put my finger on, we did not change them. Question. Do you think OPD shared the entire video of the person of interest? Some of us think there's some of the video is missing. And in fact, I will say that us here on the podcast had wondered this aloud on the show in an old episode. Answer. There are two tapes of different lengths of the car being dropped off and someone walking away and never looking back. Both are available online. Not totally sure yet, though, as we are still working through video received on a few different levels. So I can't give a straight answer on this. So it doesn't really change anything here, but did think it was worth sharing since we had talked about it in previous episodes. Question. When the dog hit the bottom of the staircase at Jennifer's condo, did the police follow up to do any further analysis, i.e. obtain prints or DNA in the staircase area? Answer, no. Question. To add to this, did the police indicate why they believe the POI's scent stopped at the bottom of the stairs? If it was a construction worker or a maintenance guy, wouldn't his scent have been all over Jennifer's complex? Again, the answer was no. Now, about the dog, there have been some information that's been sent to us about tracking dogs and perhaps them being able to struggle to follow a scent over air or stairs, over these types of stairs, which were kind of like open air stairs. I'm not sure about the validity of that, but it's worth mentioning. Question, have her work emails been looked at? Have the coworkers' emails been looked at? Answer from the family, as per case files, her complete hard drive was evaluated and nothing on it drew any attention to anything having to do with her abduction on any level. Another question that involved us. Question, in the Unconcluded podcast, they mentioned many possible sightings of Jennifer before and after her disappearance. I believe one was being forced into a car at another apartment complex, and one was with a strange man at a jewelry store. Do you believe either of these sightings were actually Jennifer? I know there is no way to be completely sure, but what is your opinion? Answer, no. However, there is no way to be completely sure. You are correct. And again, that's kind of what we expected. And I think I've talked to Drew about that before and the unlikely, you know, possibility of these being her. However, you know, if someone's saying that they think they may have saw her, again, that's why we're sharing it. We think all of the information needs to be put out there. And only from that point can you determine what's real, what's not, what's relevant, and what's not. Another question about that. In conjunction with this question, I'd be interested to know if the family thinks it's likely Jennifer was checking out another condo like the woman Erica claimed that she did in the week before she disappeared. From what I've heard about Jen, it seems very unlikely to me that she'd do this without mentioning it to anyone else in her life. The answer was no, and we agree here. I think we had talked about this when we first broadcast that interview and in subsequent episodes as well. It seems very unlike Jennifer, but we had to put it out there. We have to discuss it, and we certainly can't eliminate it as a possibility without further information. Question, was there really a master set of keys to all the condos found in another condo? Answer, a full set of complex keys was stolen approximately a month before Jennifer was taken. But it does not mention, and this is me adding on to the question here, not part of the response. It does not mention whether those were found in another condo, just that they were stolen. Question, were Huntington on the Green's security cameras date stamped 100% accurate? Answer, no, they were not. They were stuck in daylight savings time. So when the timestamp reads 1300, it's off by 1 hour. The real time was 12 p.m. We had talked about this previously at length, but again, wanted to just verify that for the people that were wondering. Question, were Jen's keys, car or apartment or mail really found? And this is going back to a question that was posted on somewhere on the internet. It's kind of escaping me at the moment about her keys possibly being found. And the answer is here, no, nothing we know that was missing the day Jennifer was taken has been found or used. So some good information there, especially since we know the Kessies have access to the files now, that none of those things have been found. They are all still missing. Question, after seeing the case files from police, have your theories about what happened to Jen changed? Answer, no, it remains a complete mystery to us all. I stick with the trafficking angle. Other family members have different thoughts, all of which have been expressed since the beginning. We are, though, taking baby steps, piecing together facts, not fiction, in hopes that it will lead us in Jennifer's direction someday. And I think, too, that's what the Kessies are doing here. By giving some of these answers to questions, they're putting the facts forward based on their information and what's supported in the case files, and narrowing down and eliminating some of these other rumors and misinformation that's still out there to this day. Question, were there any other calls or texts on her phone bill leading up to her disappearance that seemed suspicious? Answer, none that stick out to us. However, we are still grinding all the numbers within the files to see if anything leads us anywhere not obvious to us. Question, did Jen have a wall charger to her phone that was found in her condo? Answer, yes, there was a wall charger in her condo for her cell. Also, there was a car charger in her car at the time of finding it at Huntington on the Green parking lot. And this is in reference to some people have believed that possibly the fact that there was a car charger in her car, maybe she didn't charge her phone in the house, and that could be, you know, something to think about. Also, I think that it was mentioned that she usually kept the phone charger plugged in, and it was interesting that it was not plugged in the photos that had been released. But again, just information here. Yes, she did have a wall charger that she used for her phone. Question, by the time that the records were turned over to your family, did the Orlando police have any working theory, or do you feel they'd given up entirely? Answer, it is clear they have slash had many working theories. There is not any clear person or direction they are or were truly following. It was in all directions until late 2012, when all written forms of their investigation ceased. We do not have a written document or supplement from late 2012 forward to 2019. We inquired as to where they are and why we don't have them, and we were told none exist. Let that sink in a while. And I think that we had talked about this a little bit before. The fact that since 2012, they considered Jennifer Kessie's abduction a active investigation, and yet there is zero evidence of any investigation taking place, it's maddening. And I can only begin to imagine how angry the Kessie family must be over that. I couldn't imagine. Question, is it true that her mace was found on the counter of a condo, but the holder was found somewhere in Windermere? Answer, we found Jennifer's mace in her condo. The one found in Windermere, I'm not aware of Jennifer carrying two different ones. We do not have any physical evidence from Jennifer's case, only files and film. I do not recall reading anything in the files on the Windermere one. Question, have you searched any crimes that are very similar to hers and try to see if there is any connection? Answer, yes, very much so. We still investigate on that angle, but there's nothing truly prevalent to that date. Someone is going to or has slipped up in 14 years. Hopefully, we'll be there to find it or catch it when it does appear. Question, was the soil on the tire of Jennifer's car ever tested to see if it matches the soil of the lake where the tip was received about the carpet? Answer, no. It is my belief that the soil seen on Jennifer's car is from the construction of the roads in front of her workplace at the time of her disappearance. It was that white sand-looking material. But that is only my summation, having been to her workplace soon after her disappearance and seeing it myself. Question, did detectives ever search all of the apartments in the proximity of Jennifer and x-ray walls looking for a body? Answer here, no. Also, I think at this point, it's worth pointing out, if she had been placed into a wall, there would be a smell associated with that. So I think the idea of her being in a wall is probably not something that happened. Now, as far as in a foundation or something like that, then we're looking at something that would probably be a little more possible. But again, that's my opinion. Question, have you contacted any psychics or mediums to see if they could help with the case? Answer, We have had many contact us and give information, and many contact us letting us know how much they charge to give us information that we're looking for. We got and get a lot of under the palm tree near the water information. And I don't really think I need to add much to this, except for my thoughts and opinions would be right in line with Drew Kessie's. Question: does the family feel the police know who did this, but just can't prove it? Answer: I would love to think that this was the case. However, I believe authorities have many of their people thinking many different people are responsible. There is no POI clearly identified to date. Question: I would like to know exactly when Jen and Travis's cell phones were turned off. Answer: and this is going back to what we talked about a little bit earlier. Answer: me too. Long and short of the story, the ping study is, it was so unreliable because of the infancy of the technology that the pings made no sense as to time, location, and cell towers. There is no definitive time either phone was turned off. And this is all in caps. So obviously really stressing that point. Continuing with the answer. That came from a Verizon specialist's mouth, not mine. Now, to set the record straight, I myself made the statement that I believed I was told the last ping was at 10:20 p.m. on 1/23/06. That information was a figment of my imagination. It was never said to me in the meeting of my recollection, as there were many people there and none heard what I thought I heard for so many years. I myself have provided false information when it comes to the ping study, and that hurts me deeply inside. And we already discussed this earlier, but I thought it was worth sharing the second answer to that question. Question: do you think Jennifer and Michelle Parker's cases are related? Answer: no. Question: do the police have any other surveillance video relevant to the investigation other than the images of the person who parked her car? Answer: yes, we have 67 hours of film and many different businesses where they could be found. Not many cameras in 2006 as we have today. Most businesses did not catch street level views, mainly parking lots and entrances, as well as inside video too. Question: did Jen go anywhere or meet with anyone after work on Monday, January 23rd? Answer: to our knowledge, no. She went home after work on 1/23/06 and spoke with many people that evening, including myself, Logan, her mom, her friend Lauren, Rob. Then Jennifer was in bed at presumably 9:57 p.m. talking with Rob, her boyfriend at the time, saying goodnight, as phone records show. And again, based on everything that we've learned about Jennifer, I don't think that it's surprising to hear them say that. And if I had to place a bet on it, I would say that she didn't go anywhere after work on Monday, January 23rd either. But I think that's something that we have to leave open to possibility, because there's no way for knowing for sure. Question: are police willing to start fresh, starting with polygraph tests for those closest to her, reviewing alibis, etc.? Answer: no. They did that 5 times by our count in the past 14 years, and we have nothing to show for it. OPD is no longer responsible for investigating the disappearance of Jennifer. Question: the Kessies have done a lot of shows and specials on TV over the years. Do they get paid for those appearances? Answer: no. We have never been paid to appear on a show that you have seen us appear on. Not a dime. Not radio, TV, print, or online. Question: do you believe Jen was lured away by someone she knew, and that the POI was just someone who was paid to drive her car back and may not even know he's a POI? Answer: that's a very real possibility, and one of about 100 I can think of. No factual proof to support that, however, a logical summation under the circumstances. And yeah, I don't think we have anything to add here either. We've talked about that being a possibility from the very beginning. Question: was any actual DNA found that was and can be tested again in the future? Answer: I am not in a position to answer that in a factual way at this time, other than DNA does exist. And if you remember from the earlier question, he did go into a little bit more detail about this information. Now, I had talked earlier about the financial strain that the Kessies have gone through in their investigation, especially since taking over the investigation completely. So I did want to share this answer because it does share a little bit about that. Question: was any DNA sequence produced from the fiber found in her car? Just wondering a yes or a no. If yes, has your PI considered using the available genealogical public database and a forensic genealogist to get a potential match? Answer: see the previous answer, which was that he couldn't share any information. But then he continued: every avenue and resource available to us is and will be utilized. There is an incredible amount of costs involved in all we are trying to do to find Jennifer, and we simply can't move and do everything that we know we need to do at once due to the associated costs with the entire investigation. It will be a slow process due to the lack of funding. I can't put it any simpler than if we were millionaires, we would most likely have our answers. We are not, so we will painfully do what we can when we are able to do that. We greatly appreciate everyone who has helped us financially in our efforts. We are extremely humbled. Question: did the police check airline, train stations, bus stations to see if she got on, put any of these forms of transportation? Maybe someone forcing her to do this. Answer: minimal on the airlines and very local bus routes, no video, and I've read nothing they did on the other forms of transportation. Question: has anyone from the FBI given you a profile of the abductor? And if not, have you ever tried to get one to do it? Answer: FBI specifically, no. We requested one. Maybe it was done during the review of Jennifer's case, but we don't have anything in writing from them on that topic to my knowledge. FDLE, Florida Department of Law Enforcement, did a profile report, but in my opinion, it doesn't provide new information. Question: do you have any idea what Jen ate for dinner the night of Monday the 23rd? Answer: no. It is our understanding that she drove straight to work from Rob's after a vacation, had a full day of work, came home, and made calls to family and friends. I would imagine she would have nothing in the fridge, having been on vacation and not going to the grocery store that day. It's also noted that her kitchen in the condo was sparkling clean. Question, and this is kind of a follow-up question, is it possible she went out late on the 23rd for a quick bite? Is there any video or bank records to support this? Answer, we don't believe she went out. There is no video or bank transactions to support she went out. Question, what were her last bank transactions before disappearing? Answer, bank transactions will not be shared at this time. I found that interesting, and I can think of reasons why they may not want to do so, but it's certainly something that you wonder about. Like, what were the final transactions that she had showing right before she disappeared? I think it's kind of important information, but I certainly understand and appreciate that the Kessies do not want to share that at this time. Question, what happened to her car? Has it been impounded the entire time? Answer, Jennifer's car was a leased vehicle months after Jennifer was taken, and after many times worked on by crime scene techs, the car was returned to us. We kept the car garaged a few months and kept asking if the car was needed. We were told that it was okay to get rid of the car, so we had the bank take back the car. We do know where the car is and have done extensive research on what the car could yield with technology from 2006. It seems there would be little value of 14 years later and several owners down the line using the car. Although it's a tough call. OPD should have had that car impounded. Yes, we now know that. Question. Assuming you have her cell and landline records, are there any incoming or outbound calls that are just out of the ordinary? Numbers not recognized that appear multiple times that started just before her disappearance? Answer. We are still working on phone records received. They are extensive to review and difficult to work with at times. We won't share that information in this forum. Question. Is the story about Logan seeing a parked van in Jen's space true? If so, what exactly happened and did Logan actually speak to them? Answer. A van was not parked in Jennifer's spot. A white pickup truck was parked near her spot. Logan tried to speak with the occupants, but they didn't speak English. Now, this is interesting because we have previously heard and discussed that it was like a white panel van. Hearing that it's a pickup truck is certainly interesting, especially considering that there had been some rumors slash reports early in the investigation of people seeing Jennifer in a pickup truck. Also, the carpet scenario from recently where there was a possible rolled up carpet tossed into Lake Fisher from the back of a truck. This all certainly seems interesting that it is a truck as opposed to the van. But again, that's just making connections to a bunch of unconfirmed things that we are unsure about. So that pretty much covers the extent of the questions and answers that the Kessies did. And hopefully in sharing that information, we can aid in them really getting to the truth here, weeding out the inaccuracies, the false information, making sure that the things that are true are shared and are confirmed, and go from there. So we're going to process this information. We haven't really had a chance to. Scott's been out of town, and I've been waiting to kind of speak to him about some of these questions and answers. But we want to look at them again and kind of think about in reference to the things that we've been looking at on the podcast over these last couple of years, do any of these answers affect that? And I think that some of them do in small ways. And maybe we need more time to think about, is there larger ways where this could change our line of thinking? But with that, appreciate you listening. As always, if you think you know something about Jennifer's disappearance, please contact the Kesseys. They are now in charge of her investigation. And we're going to leave you there. Music in this episode is by PC3. We'll see you next time.